Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today it's the former Bishop of London, Richard Church, talking about remembering our future, history as cordial.
Thank you very much indeed. And I better say straight away that those of you who have signed up for Robert Peston, I shan't be at all offended if you leave now. Indeed, I do congratulate you on taking a punt on a bishop, because, of course, we've been mercilessly satirized throughout the centuries. It was that French philosopher Voltaire who wrote one of his letters from England and devoted it entirely to the bishops of the established church. And he began with the phrase, such is the gaucherie of the manners that the bishops learn at the universities of Oxford and Cambridge, that they are commonly compelled to content themselves with one wife only, and that usually their own. Well, he was French, of course, and I wouldn't have it any other way, darling. I really wouldn't. Now, my theme is remembering our future, history as a cordial for drooping spirits. I want to begin on a cold January morning in 1649, just before he was beheaded. King Charles I addressed one final word to William Juxon, his companion on the scaffold and my predecessor as Bishop of London. And the word was, remember. And it's a word that reverberates, and often ominously. The king's enemies at this climacteric moment, when in the words of John Evelyn, unkingship was proclaimed, were very naturally anxious to know what precisely the king meant. Juxon was summoned to a parliamentary committee of inquiry, and the question was put to him. What did the king mean by this word, remember? Juxon's disarming reply to the parliamentary commissioners perhaps reveals why he did not himself end on the scaffold as his friend and patron, Archbishop Laud, had done. The bishop said, well, the king knew that I was terribly absent-minded. He'd given me the Great George of the Order of the Garter to give to the Prince of Wales, and he didn't want me to forget. The answer deflected suspicion. Juxon was simply consigned to internal exile and his favourite fox hunting in the Cotswolds. He did, however, faithfully discharge the king's will, the Great George, a cameo of St. George and the Dragon set in gold and studded with diamonds, was given to the Prince of Wales, later Charles II. He bequeathed it to his brother, James, who took it with him into exile in 1688. Thereafter, it passed down the Stuart line until Henry Cardinal Duke of York sold it to the Marquis Wellesley, who in turn sold it to his brother, Arthur, Duke of Wellington, in whose family it remains. Yet the parliamentary commissioners were right to be disturbed by the reverberations of remember. Memories of the king's piety and his martyr's death outlived and effaced the record of his political ineptitude and his inconsistency. Memories of the royal martyr played a role in the restoration of his son in 1660. And one of the earliest uses of the phrase, a cordial for drooping spirits, was actually in a letter written by one Thomas Walmsley and published in 1659. It is entitled, A Handkerchief for Loyal Mourners, or A Cordial for Drooping Spirits, Groaning for the Bloody Murder and Heavy Loss of Our Gracious King. And this command to remember reverberates through the history of many peoples. I've just returned from giving a series of talks on the countries bordering the River Danube. In Bratislava, the capital of Slovakia, I was moved to see the Holocaust Memorial, marking the site of the demolished synagogue with the simple but stark injunction in Hebrew and Slovak, Zachor, remember. The Danubian countries demonstrate the power and the peril of historical memory. The building bricks of nationhood have been first and foremost a common language, and then some shared historical memories consecrated in territorial and institutional expressions. The British, have, on the whole, done well out of history, and Irish friends can perhaps better appreciate the passion with which debates about history are conducted in the successor states of the Habsburg Empire, where national identity invests sometimes very remote periods with huge emotional freight. In the case of Slovakia, the short history of Greater Moravia, they talk of nothing else in Salisbury Market, 8833 to 907, this very brief period has assumed a pivotal role in the recent development of Slovak identity. By about 907, however, the realm of Greater Moravia disintegrated, and the Slovaks became part of the Kingdom of Hungary for 1,000 years, and they found themselves in a state which also embraced South Slavs, Croats, Serbs, and East Slav Ruthenians as well. All these people have their own fiercely maintained historical title deeds crucial to their identity, and the conflicts between them illustrate the importance of forgetting as part of wisely and creatively remembering the past. It was a Czech political scientist, Karl Deutsch, who, with his profound knowledge of the history of Central Europe, claimed that the definition of a nation is a group of people united by a mistaken view about the past and hatred of their neighbors. The past cannot be changed, but we are responsible for how we remember it. And what we extract and carry forward from what has gone before creates possibilities for the future or closes them off. In a very important sense, we remember the future. In this creative activity of remembering, impartiality is not possible, but honesty is a duty. Remembering is not so much taking down a file from the shelf containing a fixed representation of some past event, as it is about recombining multiple sources of information and experience to create a memory that lives. Plato, in the ancient world, saw memory as a process in which experiences or perceptions were encoded, stored, and then retrieved. In more modern times, Frederick Bartlett, the first professor of experimental psychology in the University of Cambridge, in his very influential 1932 book, Remembering, argued that memory was not so much reproduction as reconstruction, shaped by our mental furniture. Memory involves an effort after meaning, and that is why the writing of history is always, in the end, art rather than a science, although it is an art which must be practiced with proper discipline. Public remembering in the form of commemorations and festivals has always contributed powerfully to the sense of identity among groups or nations. And it's also true that what and who we remember as individuals plays a vital role in the construction of our own identity. And we are sad when, with the onset of dementia, more and more of a person's memories are lost, until that most painful point when someone we love cannot even recognize us. What made the Israelites a people distilled from the multitude of nomadic clans wandering the ancient Near East was their memory of their encounters with God, a story constantly rehearsed in their cultic assemblies. The very earliest creed recorded in the Hebrew scriptures begins not with some abstract philosophical affirmation, but with this phrase, "A wandering Aramean was my father." The central act which creates the Christian community is also an anamnesis, a not forgetting, a memory of the night in which Jesus had a last meal with his friends and was betrayed by one of them. Rather than merely recalling the past, this remembrance was a way in which Jesus confided his future in the world to his friends. It is unfortunately too often true that Christians have far too frequently misused their memories in the service not of remembering communities, but of dismembering them. But the power of memory and remembering is such that it has been the ambition of every would-be tyranny to control our memories. In George Orwell's dystopia 1984, the personnel of the Ministry of Truth work to destroy the records of the past. They print new up-to-date editions of old newspapers and books, knowing that the corrected version will soon be replaced by another reconnected one. The intention is to nationalize personal and corporate memories and to make people more malleable. Our memories constitute our identity, and deprived of them by degrees, we become incapable of questioning anything we are told to believe. No British government has ever set out to control memories with the rigor that the Soviet authorities, for example, brought to the task. But there have been modest and well-intentioned efforts to edit the British, and especially the English, story in the hopes of opening the way to a kinder and more tolerant future. I remember in particular how the anniversary of the Battle of Trafalgar in 2005 was observed. Nelson is buried in St. Paul's Cathedral. Actually, he's buried in the sepulchre which was intended to house the more substantial frame of Cardinal Wolsey. Good Trivial Pursuit question, that. And it was very natural to assemble 200 years on to recall the Admiral's death and the significance of the battle which preserved our islands from invasion. There was a large attendance of service chiefs, and even the French military attaché was there. Members of the royal family were there in force, but not a single government minister. It was not an event which suited the promotion of cool Britannia and reflected the impatience with history which was such a marked feature of Tony Blair's tenure as Prime Minister. As he wrote at the beginning of his autobiography, he intended to write about the events of his political career, quotes, not as a historian, but as a leader. Now, I'm not on the whole cynical about politicians. I believe that any country that denigrates those who offer themselves for public office gets the low level of leadership it deserves. I do not doubt, for example, that the Iraq campaign was conceived as a humanitarian intervention in the conviction that Western liberal democracy was the shape of things to come and was the answer to a universal yearning. Alas, ignorance of the particular history and culture of the region and a lack of humility about the virtues of Western liberal democracy itself led the Anglo-American coalition into a cavalier policy of regime change which has brought chaos in its wake. It may be that a man who has a sense of history and very little sense of destiny is a somewhat tedious fellow, but there is no doubt that a man with a sense of destiny and no sense of history is a very dangerous fellow. Trafalgar is also well worth remembering as an example of that martial spirit which has kept our island secure over many centuries and preserved the English from the devastation periodically inflicted on the territories of our European neighbours. Trafalgar was a defensive action won by courage and innovative tactics under an admiral who gave his life in the hour of victory. Once upon a time, everyone knew Nelson's signal before the battle. England expects every man to do his duty. Now, however, our children are not always well served by how history is taught in our schools. Inspecting my daughter's GCSE history syllabus, I discovered that the focus was on Twiggy and the Vietnam War, with a lurch into ancient times represented by the Wall Street crash. There has never been a generation better informed about now, with so little sense of how we came to be here. every child in the country ought to have the opportunity of meeting Lord Nelson and considering his legacy. Amnesia can undo civilizations. They die in the night when no one can remember why once upon a time they inspired self-sacrifice. There are some times in history when it is proper to agree with John Tolland, the rationalist, who said, with the horrific experience of civil war so present to his mind, "We prefer the quiet, good-natured hypocrite to the implacable, turbulent zealot of any kind." But in times of danger, unless there are people who have a lively sense of what is worth living and dying for, then our freedom to live at peace as a society is at risk. The cost involved in this lively sense of what is at stake and the need to make choices is huge, and the accounts of the horrific suffering involved in the Battle of Trafalgar should preserve us from any temptation to glorify war. Warriors have to face up to the reality of battle, which is why they are commonly less belligerent than armchair generals. But at such times of decision, leaders need to make contact with a sense of foundational conviction, which is fed by a memory of what England expects. This is the source of healthy self-confidence and the ability to master fear and to encourage people in the most extreme circumstances. Any educational system which hopes to produce effective leaders and followers must take the formation of these foundational convictions very seriously, and history is one of the ways in which this is effected. One of the hopeful aspects of our life in contemporary England is the growing involvement of young people in commemorations like the decidedly non-triumphalist ceremonies in Whitehall on Remembrance Sunday. When I began to be involved more than 20 years ago as Dean of the Chapel Royal, the first thing any journalist would say, "Come on, the war was a very long time ago. Isn't it time we moved on?" Nowadays, no one asks that question, and the crowds grow in numbers and respect every year. Geoffrey Hill, the poet, cried out, "Ingratitude still gets to me. The unfairness and waste of survival, a nation with so many memorials but no memory." The host of people year by year in Whitehall show that many are capable of gratitude, and this is indeed a cordial for drooping spirits. Remembrance Sunday is, of course, a British and a Commonwealth commemoration, as we remember the contribution of all the nations of these islands, as well as literally millions from the Indian subcontinent and other parts of the former British Empire. And it is undeniable that in the retreat from empire, publicly sanctioned commemorations of the English story in particular have changed, often for the better. Yet, as the other nations of the British Isles recover a proper sense of their own unique identity, notably the Scots, under the influence of the greatest living Scotsman, Mel Gibson, in Braveheart, the contemporary impoverishment of the English story becomes ever more embarrassing. This might be thought to be a good development and the prelude to a more tolerant and inclusive society, and it certainly is true that in the context of the 21st century, there is a need to incorporate new participants and to weave new strands into the story of England and the English. This has happened over and over again in our history and is indeed one of its most important themes. But the deliberate attempt to forget or deny what we have been leads to corporate delusion and a vacuum which is too easily filled with fits of irrational anger and scapegoating. Any refusal of the responsibility to remember wisely and creatively will have malign consequences. It is in fact true that by every statistical measure, life in our country is for most people safer, longer, and more comfortable than it ever has been in our history. Yet a plethora of polls suggests that there is a pervasive gloom about our future and that we are suffering from a national fit of the vapours. And as Brexit approaches, there seems to be a loss of English self-confidence in our capacity to make a creative contribution to what will be a very different and multipolar world. There is abundant evidence that we are in a period of transition. The liberal democratic order, which emerged under American leadership after the Second World War and was confirmed by the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, is being challenged. In addition to an illiberal trend in Eastern Europe, the fact that the largest opposition party in the Bundestag after the last German election is Alternative for Germany should concern us. And this new situation has come upon us very suddenly. It was as recently as 1992 that Francis Fukuyama, the American sage, in his book The End of History, thought that he had identified, quotes, the end point of mankind's ideological evolution, the universalization of Western liberal democracy as the final form of human government. There are still people who believe that this is the long-term trend, whatever the blips along the way. But John Gray, one of the most perceptive commentators on the way we are now, in a recent essay in The New Statesman, thinks that there has been a profound liberal misreading of history. He argues that the liberal democratic vision is of, quotes, a world without precedent, in which nationalism and religion will no longer be deciding forces in politics, and rivalry for territory and resources will have been left behind, while basic freedoms will be protected in a universal framework of human rights. In reality, he goes on to say, liberal regimes are not freestanding structures of laws and rights. They are political constructions that depend for their survival on hard power and popular acceptance. And both these foundations are eroding. The hard power was supplied by the unchallengeable American hegemony of the past 75 years. America is now chastened by the chaos following the attempts to impose the liberal order on Iraq, Libya, Syria, and the unending war in Afghanistan. And she's also being challenged by alternative models of government and economic development, notably in China. But what about popular acceptance, which is more of a concern nearer to home? Polls reveal a considerable pessimism about the prospects for social mobility and rising living standards in the most developed liberal countries. Revolutions, it should be remembered, are made not by the poor, but by the disappointed. And there are many people, not least in the UK, who believe that they will not enjoy the opportunities that their parents had. It's perfectly rational, with globalization and AI, to anticipate the contraction of the market for the labor, particularly of modestly skilled men, and a consequent loss of dignity and self-respect among this vulnerable group. There have been attempts to bolster popular acceptance by inserting an emphasis on so-called British values in the education curriculum. Ofsted has defined British values as democracy, the rule of law, individual liberty and mutual respect, and I imagine that hardly anyone here would want to dissent from those. The problem is that it is very difficult to translate these worthy abstractions into transformative energy with a real impact on the lives of individuals. Universal aspirations have to be embedded in a particular community and its institutions and its memories before they can influence those of us who are not given to abstractions. They must be carried by particular stories with iconic figures capable of generating proper pride if they're to have a deep impact. a snatch of conversation from many years ago when I was the Bishop of Stepney haunts me. After some communal rioting in the East End, I visited a number of schools with a message that we ought to respect one another's cultures. I was confronted by a furious white teenager on the Isle of Dogs who said, "What's my effing culture then, Bish?" We were very informal, I'm afraid, in the Diocese of London. I've had to do better now moving to Wiltshire. But he spoke from a sense of poverty and a loss of self-respect, which too easily translates into hostility and even violence towards outsiders. You cannot exorcise the demonic by creating a spiritual vacuum. In his discussion of democracy, Aristotle notes the tendency of democracies defined by their common memories and their moral compass to deteriorate into what he calls ochlocracies, ruled by a crowd of atomized individuals swept by gusts of anger, stimulated by sophists who would today, I suppose, probably locate themselves in the social media. This creates an unstable situation, and Aristotle suggests that the next step is some kind of tyranny. And in our case, it could well be of the administrative kind, equipped with a vastly increased capacity for surveillance and social control. In the past, religion and patriotism have contributed to a sense of national identity. In the recent past, they've often been seen as subversive of the liberal project. But the warning is that if they're banished to the shadowy margins away from the challenge to provide a reasonable account of themselves in the public square, they can easily become toxic. And it's time to reassess our engagement with both faith communities and a sane patriotism, and to balance our understandable concern about extremism with a clearer recognition of the resources that both faith and love of one's country can provide in the restoration of hope for the future. It's true that attempts have been made by what are described as right-wing populists, both in the UK and in Europe, to use Christian symbolism to demonize the other, often Muslims. Fascinatingly, however, recent surveys, reported by Tobias Kramer in his recent article, Defenders of the Faith, have demonstrated that such strategies, using Christian symbolism to demonize the other, are least effective in persuading practicing as against merely cultural Christians. Regular churchgoers are least likely, for example, to support AfD in Germany. A properly critical historical examination of the English story reveals that there are, in fact, a number of competing views of the past which have nevertheless been contained within the structure of our institutions. Robert Toombs, in his excellent recent book, The English and Their History, which I hope features in Waterstones, provides an impressive and readable account of these competing views. They are given striking pictorial form in a corridor in the Palace of Westminster, leading to the lobby of the House of Lords. On one side of the corridor is the nonconformist Republican account of the Civil War, beginning with the failure of the King to arrest dissident members of the House of Commons, and including the departure of the Pilgrim Fathers to establish their theocracy in New England. On the other side is the Royalist story, which begins with the King unfurling his standard and concludes with the Puritan governor of Windsor Castle preventing Bishop Juxon again from reading the prayer book burial service over the body of the erstwhile monarch. By 1649, of course, both bishops and the Book of Common Prayer had been outlawed. The English story contains both conformist and nonconformist traditions, and it permits rapid adaptation while preserving the theatre and the props of tradition and continuity. The memory of these competing strands in our historical experience has bequeathed to many of us a suspicion of utopias and zealots, a preference for gradual change and preservation of the institutional theatre with a disposition to see compromise as a victory rather than as a retreat and a betrayal. The new unanchored populism and loss of historical memory is a threat to this sane tradition. I found the tabloid headlines branding the judges as enemies of the people for upholding the rule of law against vociferous sections of the media especially disturbing. It is crucial, I believe, to celebrate our particular inheritance of English law. No one, not even the king, should be above the law, and this was the central message distilled from the otherwise very pragmatic comments of Magna Carta about such matters as fish weirs on the Thames. "Is Magna Carta nothing to you?" said Tony Hancock. Did she die in vain? But I wonder whether schoolchildren are still taught that wonderful story of Prince Hal and his encounter with the Lord Chief Justice as recorded in the second part of Shakespeare's Henry IV. But there are more recent examples. I recently attended a commemoration of Stephen Lawrence, a young man murdered 25 years ago, and it is an event which we should weave into our living historical memories. Nor the fact that despite attempts to frustrate justice, the perseverance of his mother Doreen and the law in the person of Sir William McPherson forced powerful institutions to face up to their failings. That is also a vital part of the English story, which is always evolving to incorporate new themes. And the mention of Henry IV brings me to the English language, which in Tudor times was the speech of a people inhabiting their island on the edge of mainland Europe, a very small number of people in that age, but which now is an international means of communication between many different peoples. The struggles of the Danubian countries to achieve nationhood were in every case bound up with the development of a vernacular language, which in most cases only took their modern forms in the 19th century. Hungary, for example, used Latin as the language of administration until the first half of the 19th century. English, by contrast, is recognizably the language we speak now as early as the 14th century in the poems of Geoffrey Chaucer. The Book of Common Prayer and the various translations of the Bible indebted to William Tyndale established a language remarkable for its expressive power and its nuances. You don't have to be highly religious to accept this point and to rejoice in that inheritance. And the most vital part of remembering our future is to ensure that our children are equipped to inherit and enjoy this astonishing treasure. It's crucial that no focus on contemporary fads dims the seriousness with which we engage with the classic texts of our language, and Shakespeare in particular, who has the words for every season. In Shakespeare's day, England was also undergoing a cultural revolution. The old world of his youth in Stratford was passing away. His birthplace was stigmatized by those of a Puritan persuasion as, quotes, an ungodly place on the blind side of the diocese. In consequence, he was steeped in the imaginative world of pre-Reformation England with its fairies and its enchanted Forest of Arden. He was expected in these circumstances by some to be more committed in the ideological battles which raged at a time when warring Christian absolutisms were busy over-defining mystery in the interests of polemics. Instead, he drew on the resources of the old world as he held up a mirror to his own times. he reflects the world described by his contemporary John Donne, the Dean of St. Paul's, as one in which 'tis all in pieces, all coherence gone. The search for truth then as now was not a simple matter of adopting some consistent ideological position. As Donne said, on a huge hill, cragged and steep, truth stands, and he that will reach her about must and about must go. The elusive authorial persona of William Shakespeare exhibits skepticism about conventional pieties and official propaganda. As beloved Falstaff said, what is honour? A word. Honour is a mere scutcheon. The sentiment is echoed in Henry V, where alongside the stirring patriotic speeches, there is a vivid evocation of the horrors of a war, which begins with the bishops plotting how to distract the king from an imminent raid on church coffers by inciting him to invade France. Shakespeare gives us multiple viewpoints, but in particular, he gives us the stranger's case, the view of the outsider. He collaborated in the play on Thomas More, in which More confronts a xenophobic crowd bent on mischief against the economic migrants in their midst. And in a passionate speech, Moore, as scripted by Shakespeare, appeals to their common humanity and concludes, this is the stranger's case, and this your mountainish inhumanity. Shakespeare shows us the face of compassion in an age of ideological passion, when human beings did atrocious things to one another on principle. It sounds all too contemporary. The theme of his last plays, however, is the possibility of redemption through the divine, through nature, through children. And it may be that the speech given to Theseus in the play on which he collaborated, The Two Noble Kinsmen, was actually the last thing Shakespeare wrote for the stage. It is an address to the inscrutable gods. O you heavenly charmers, what things you make of us. For what we lack, we laugh. For what we have, are sorry, still are children in some kind. Let us be thankful for that which is, and with you leave disputes that are above our question. Let's go off and bear us like the time. Ours is an age where all over the globe, in the many places where the Globe Company has played Hamlet, traditional cultures are eroding under the pressure of our new digital age, just as they were in England in Shakespeare's time. It is not clear what future is coming to meet us, but Shakespeare's language, his humanity and humour constitute a treasury which shows no signs of being exhausted, a treasury for reflection, for wisdom, and endurance in our times. To sum up our review of Remembering the Future, it is obvious that a picture of Churchill's Britain still casts its spell over many people as the reaction to the recent films Darkest Hour and Dunkirk demonstrate. But ever since the rebellion of the sensitive self in the social convulsions of the 1960s, there has been an elite unease about celebrating the English story. I believe that it can be celebrated without blimpishness, and that a critical reading of English history has resources which will assist us to make a wise and constructive contribution to the future, both for ourselves and the wider world of which we are a part. We should not be a nation with an abundance of memorials but no living memory. And as we properly remember the failures and the crimes, we should also be grateful for the martial traditions which have preserved our island. We should revel in our language and entrust it to the next generation by opening up for them the word store, which is contained in our great texts. We should respect profoundly our tradition of English law and appreciate the ways in which our institutions have contained conflict and made a virtue of compromise. We should recognise our debt to the strangers, to successive waves of new arrivals who have contributed to the dynamism of the English story, making us, in the words of Daniel Defoe in his True Born Englishman, quotes, a mongrel, half-bred race. But above all, we should show our gratitude for this land, cherish its beauty, and combat its pollution. This dear, dear land, this blessed plot, this earth, this realm, this England.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.